said earlier, on these two Cowboys cricket club's most successful ever captain, which is true. I mean, we won 7 games in a row when I was skipper of the second team, and no other Cowboys cricket team ever won 7 games in a row. What he very kindly never also said is also I was the least successful second team cricket captain the following season, losing 13 games in a row. Both of those remain club records, so thank you for that, Rog. Yeah, I'm going to do one of my little rants, and I've usually managed to entertain at least somebody in the audience with these over the last couple of years, so I hope you'll at least find this entertaining. And I'm going for thought provoking, and obviously it's been radical history, maybe a little bit radical. The title for my little effort today is Why History Matters and Why Basketball History Matters More. And I do believe that I wouldn't have spent, you know, all those years knocking together a PhD in Cornish history if I didn't think history was important and I didn't think history matters. And I suppose the key thing about that why history matters, if it's radical history or traditional history, why it matters. History is not just about yesterday, and it's not just about the past. And you could say it's not even about yesterday, and it's not even about the past. It's about now, and it's about the future. The way we understand and think about what we see around us in the world now, what we experience in the world now, is shaped by our understanding of what's gone before us and our history. And our understanding of our sense of the possibilities for the future is also constrained and conditioned by what we know of what's happened in the past. And so our history is crucially important. It's a crucially important discipline, a crucially important subject for us to know about, to be able to understand the present we live in, and to develop possibilities for the sort of future that we might experience. And so I'm going to just contemplate aloud a little bit about the sort of history that I'm all up with, the sort of history that I learned in school, and the sort of history that's probably pretty common to most people wandering around out there. And the history I learned at school, at the O-level and A-level, was, and there's a technical term for this, was teleological. And it was based on teleology, which is a highly technical term, which basically means it was based on the idea of progress. And it was based on the idea that you look at history, and you see through history, things are getting better all the time. Because what we've got now, and how we live now, is great, and it's the pinnacle of human achievement. Because everything we've done, everything we've discovered, and everything we've learned has enabled us to live how we're living now. And history is a story of how we got to where we are now. And we did the history of the Industrial Revolution, and it was all about great technologies, great new technologies, like the steam engine meant that we could produce more things, and you could produce them better, and you could produce them faster, and ever more useful machines for doing things. And there was the growth in science, and the growth in medicine, and cure diseases, and everything's getting better, and everything's improving, and we're living better lives now than our grandparents were when they were our age, and they were living better lives than their grandparents were in their age. And there's this whole teleological, what they call teleological approach to history. And that's like a fairly sort of standard history, and everything that happened in the past wasn't as good as what's happening now. We're better people, we understand more, we're cleverer, we know more, we can go and see more places, we can watch things on the telly. You couldn't do that 300, 400 years ago, you know, well, must be dreadful. So that's the teleological thing, and that's basically, I think, the way that most people have learned and been taught history, certainly, in this country, in schools. The basic understanding of history is the march of progress towards this, if not perfect society, we're certainly getting there. And we only need a few tweaks in our democracy, maybe, and we can get it just about right. So that's one way of looking at history, and that would be a fairly traditional approach to history. Through studying history, through looking at history, through thinking a lot about what's happened in the past, thinking a lot about the large-scale trends that you can observe, these changes that Dave is talking about that are invisible to a generation and maybe invisible over 4 or 5 generations, but actually become visible over that long period of time. And I dominated by, oh, I'll give Chandler a radical Marxism being central to my thinking, by the way. We'll get that in anyway, but I'll just get that away now. What particularly attracted me looking at the different schools of historical thought, and I got into looking in West Cornwall, I was about the history of everyday life. I was interested in, so never interested in what the king was doing, I was never interested in what the lords and barons were doing, I was never interested in what was happening in Parliament. I want to know, how did people live? What were their everyday lives like? And I had a period of time, 1588 to 1750, and a series of documents, and looked in detail at the history of everyday life. What was it like being a single parent? What happened to you when you retired? What happened to you when you first had kids? How did that all go? What was that like? And that was the sort of history that I got interested in. And then the conclusion I've come to, the conclusion other historians have come to, and that I've come to agree with and to believe from my examination of the evidence that's available to me about Cornwall, is that if you look at the history of everyday life and people's day-to-day lives and how they lived, then for most of human history, like the last 20,000 years, say, you know, a long argument about, I'm going to have another go at Dick Wallace, Erech and Homo sapiens, 500,000 BC, was it you were claiming, Dick? Yeah. So is that 500,000 years of human history? You know, maybe 20,000 years of human history, 40,000 years, whatever you like. It's a long, 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 long time human beings have been on this planet. And if you look at how people have lived their lives, and you then read books by people like Leroy Ladgeri, Fernand Braudel, the Annales School of History, which comes out of France, which is the history of la longue durée, the history of changes over very long periods of time. And what those people are saying, and what I've come to believe, is actually, in terms of everyday lived experience, nothing much has changed for people since the dawn of human history. In fact, there might be, you could say, over two big things that changed. People figured out a long, long time ago that they could scratch a little rut in the soil and they could put some seeds in it and then new plants would sprout up. Before that, people used to run around killing animals and picking berries and pulling up roots wherever they found them. And they were scavengers and hunters and gatherers, those sorts of society. Someone figured out, somehow, that you could actually decide where you were going to grow things, and you could domesticate animals. And so there was a development of agriculture, way, 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 way back. Way, way back. And following the development of agriculture, in terms of people's everyday lives, and I'm talking about 99% of the people, I think, that have ever lived on the planet, what their lives were about was about growing their own food. It was about living in small communities. It was about cooperating within those small communities to make sure that those small communities had enough to eat every year. And not just cooperating to make sure they had enough to eat every year, but cooperating in the way they worked the land and worked their animals to make sure that their children would have land which they could live off in the future. And their children could have land which they could live off in the future. And actually, when we look at that now from the telescope of the 21st century, we call that sustainability. It's actually what the human species practice on this earth for, you know, 99% of them, for the vast bulk of human history. People have lived self-sufficient farming communities, small communities, in a cooperative sense, growing their own food. And actually, if you woke up all the dead people and spoke to them, as I say, I reckon 99% of them, that would be the life that they'd experience. And actually, if you were living in Britain in 1000 BC, and you were living in Britain in 1000 AD, and you met one of your ancestors, your 2000 years difference, your life would not be materially much different. You would still be living in a little small community somewhere farming. And you might be chasing a couple of cows around and milking them, or you might be growing some root vegetables, or whatever you're doing. Things didn't really change. Of course, people paid rent, but in the scheme of things, the intervention of the state and the intervention of your lords and masters, for most people, for most of the time, would have been marginal. And people would have just carried on their lives. So there's that change when people stop being hunter-gatherers and start developing agriculture. And then through Brodel and Roy Lajoury and the announcement of history, long-during people, the other big change is industrialisation and the development of capitalism. Where are we going to locate the development of capitalism? Well, sort of when I was at school, it was around about 1750 when James Watt was boiling his kettle and realised he could put the little wheel on it and it'd make it go round, and they invented the steam engine. Whatever happened then, that was maybe the start of capitalism. Dave's pushing it back into the 1550s, maybe. So let's say, picking up on Dave's reading of Marx, that capitalism was born around the 1550s, was it, Dave? 1480s, 1550s, we've been living in a developing age of capitalism. In terms of the scale and the duration of the survival of the human species on the planet, that's like 5 minutes. This world that we're living in, that's our norm, that we come to expect, in terms of the dimensions of human history, is a blip. It's a tiny moment in time. It's still developing. Is it 200 years, 300 years, 400 years we've lived under capitalism? Well, actually, we lived for 20,000, 30,000 years as small-scale peasant farmers. So, what is this? What is capitalism all about? What is this world we're living in? And what happens to that idea of progress? Is everything better under capitalism? What were those radical struggles about? What were the Luddites all about when they were trying to smash up machines? The history I was taught was, well, they were conservative people and they didn't recognise progress. Actually, they were protecting a way of life which had functioned for thousands and thousands of years, which had worked for the vast majority of ordinary people in their day-to-day lives for thousands and thousands of years. What happens in the 1480s, in the 1550s, in the 1650s, is you get the development of a class of people, which we eventually come to call the bourgeoisie, who quite deliberately set out to pervert the way in which the human being lives his life, to change the landscape and disrupt the symbiosis that the human animal has achieved with the landscape and with the planet. And when I start thinking about this, I then start thinking about James Lovelock's Gaia theory, the Gaia hypothesis, where his, I'm never quite sure if he means it literally or as a metaphor, and I'm not sure he's quite sure either, that the planet is a single living organism that sustains itself, that balances all the things that are happening on the planet are designed to keep the planet going. And actually, the human species, for however many thousand years, when it was practicing sustainable agriculture, when people were living as peasants, when people were working together in their families and small communities to feed themselves, was living in balance with the planet. Now, we all know, because we're being hammered all the time about our carbon footprint and climate change. I notice they don't call it global warming anymore, now it's bloody freezing in October all the time, and it rains in summer. It's now called climate change. That the way that the human being, the human animal, is operating in the planet is not, you've lost that symbiotic relationship with the Gaia organism. Capitalism will eat itself, and it will eat the rest of us with it. The air is not fit to breathe in large parts of the world. The water is not fit to drink. There are approaching 9 billion people living in the planet, and there's just no way on earth that you can sustainably feed all those people. What Marx thought was going to happen, and he is ideas about capital and the overthrow of capital. Marx said that capitalism will collapse under the weight of its own contradictions. That the fact that a few people could exploit the many was itself unsustainable because the many would eventually achieved class consciousness and would realise the degree of their exploitation and would overthrow their bourgeois ruling class, and then you'd get socialist society, and then from socialism, communism would develop. And then there was a stage beyond communism, which was each according to his wants and each according to his needs, which actually would have looked very much like small-scale peasant agriculture and small communities providing for themselves. Maybe. The contradiction of capitalism was going to fall apart because of the inbuilt nature of capitalist societies to compete with each other and capitalist economies to compete with each other. And in order for us to compete, our British steel industry to compete with the German steel industry, we had to have better technology than them. We had to be able to use more steel more cheaply than Germans. So we would have to bring new technology to bear, and to get our workers to operate that new technology more effectively, we would have to educate them. And for Marx, the seeds of the destruction of capitalism, the contradiction of capitalism, was by educating the workforce to maintain your competitiveness, you were also educating them to understand that their class destiny. You were also educating them to come to realise they're being exploited. And actually, there's a million of us, and there's one boss, and those sons just don't add up. Capitalists made up this as well, of course, and were very careful not to allow those particular contradictions of capitalism to emerge, specialised education. And if you look at the television, we see a classic example of what Gramsci calls false consciousness. The capitalist class doesn't want the working class to realise how it's being exploited. It wants people to think of themselves as individuals, it wants people to think of their own destiny being entirely within their own control. And so it gives you things like television and entertainment and all the rest of that. So you sit in your house and you have all your experiences vicariously and you don't get together and you don't talk to people. That's probably a highly contentious argument. But false consciousness prevented the contradictions of capitalism arising in the way Marx thought they were going to. But it seems fairly clear to me that the contradiction of capitalism, which Marx didn't anticipate because he saw it happening somewhere else, was this whole environmental one. The fact that if we carry on consuming and we carry on producing, in the way we're consuming and producing, the contradiction of capitalism, the fact that what makes it unsustainable is going to actually kill us all. I don't think there's much argument about the fact that it's going to kill us all, really. Sea level's going to rise and those people are going to lose their homes, and those people in those parts of the world are just going to drown because they're not going to have anywhere to go. The water's not going to be drinkable, the ozone layer's going to go, and we're all going to get skin cancer. And Gaia, the self-sustained organism, will sort things out for itself. And it will scorch us and drag us off the face of the planet. That's the contradiction of capitalism, the one that we're up against. And this leads me to the analogy that I guess I want to leave you with. An analogy for capitalism. And capitalism has been thought of in lots of different ways, lots of different metaphors for capitalism. And I've just come to think of capitalism and capitalist society as cancerous, and that we should understand capitalism as a cancer on the planet. And if you think about capitalism, it's got some of the key characteristics of cancer. The planet, and we are part of the planet, part of the organism, is attacking itself. In order to fuel the industrial revolution, we've dug inside the skin of the planet and we've hacked out all that coal, and we've sucked out all that oil, and we've burnt it, and pumped it up into the atmosphere. I'm totally against the long-term interests of the planet. As an organism, as the we on the planet, have turned against it. We've turned against the organism. We're part of it, but we're like rogue cells attacking it. So you get cancer cells, and they go rogue in your body, and they start attacking you. And they start creating obstructions, and things go wrong. The other thing they do is proliferate. And the human species has proliferated enormously. And there's something about the rate of doubling of human population. And between 1000 AD and 1900 AD, I think the population of the planet doubled. I think it's doubled three times since 1900. And the rate of doubling of the population is down under 30 years at the moment. It's enormous exponential increases in population. And under capitalism, the only way we've got to feed people and to maintain human population is by being ever more rapacious with the planet and chewing up more of it and using it and using it and using it and killing it. So I just think, you know, my thinking, this is a bit of a dire note to leave everybody on, isn't it, really? I really should have a better punchline for the end of this. But I did warn you it would be radical. What does that leave us for the future? How have we got to think about our future? I guess there's people on the hard left who are still looking for the classic Marxist revolution. They're still looking to destabilise industrial economies. Certainly my involvement in the trade union movement, there's a lot of hard left jokers in the trade union movement who thought that by provoking mass strikes and industrial unrest, you could undermine society and you could create a socialist utopia, which itself would bring about a revolution and bring about a more sensible way of doing things and overthrow capitalism. I really think the moment for that has gone, but I think the key conflict, the key side of conflict and the key contradiction is in the environment. And I guess the only way we need to understand the environmental issues in the Marxist context and see that the environmental crisis and the environmental catastrophe that we're facing is the ultimate contradiction of capitalism. And maybe there is some way of bringing together radical green thinking with radical Marxist thinking and producing a way forward from that. Which basically means a lot of people in a generation or two are going to have to decide not to have any more children. And we're going to have to reduce the population by 90%. That sort of seems to be the only way out to me. Well, it is fascist, isn't it? But what's the choice? I know. There's one there, and then I'll pick you up afterwards.
I agree with everything else, but really it's not a question of population, because most people on this planet are living really sustainably, and they're poor people, and it's because they're not so able to consume everything that capitalism is trying to drive all these kind of needs into people, that we've got to have all these things that we don't need, and all the waste that capitalism generates constantly, the new things all the time, all these new chemicals that they're coming out with. It's just like people have another version of shampoo so that, you know, somebody can make money and somebody else. The whole thing of capitalism is terribly bad for the environment, but it's got nothing to do with the population, because we're consuming here, you know, 100 times our ecological footprint, and people in other places don't even get a look at this. It's not about the population. We could all live easily on this planet. But people do, you know, people aren't going to have millions and millions of children. You know, people have a lot of children because they feel they need to do that because some are going to die and they need to kind of support the family and blah, blah, blah. There's lots of reasons why some people have big families. But if people had better choices and were living in a safe world, they wouldn't have to have lots of children. People would just want to have a future. You don't have to control how many children people are living in. That's not the problem. It's what capitalism is not exactly forcing us to do, but playing on our human abilities or our humanness to make us do things that are controlling nothing whatsoever. The population, we've got to take that out of the argument, because that's saying people are the problem, people aren't the problem, capitalism is the problem.
Yeah, a couple of bits on that. I'm not sure that I'm right and you're wrong, to be honest. And that's certainly food for thought. I do think that there are lots of poor people in the world. There are lots of people living sustainably. I think capitalism is pushing those societies increasingly into the margins. I think that Africa is increasingly being used by the people that want to grow GM crops. They want to grow coffee and they want to grow tea so that we can consume it in the West. And that those bits of our global society which have been functioning sustainably are being increasingly marginalised by capitalism. And it is getting increasingly rapacious. And it is firing into the rainforests and digging in them. And it is, you know, the Sahara Desert gets bigger and bigger and bigger because of intensive agriculture at its margins. where they just hammer that land for 5 or 6 years and destroy it, where they get those peasant producers in there who've been minding their own business, they trap them into wage slavery. So I mean, I'm concerned that, you know, those pockets of sustainability, which are wealthy in the terms that we understand them, and I mean, none of us think that wealth has got much to do with living a fulfilling life, and that the richness of experience depends on 37 TV channels and a flash car. There's no reason to think a peasant isn't as live as rich a life as anybody else. I mean, the population bit, it is just the level of proliferation, and I wonder how far that is about capitalism demanding more customers and more workers, and it being seen as the only way globally, and it's being forced on all different parts of the world. So you see where the population explosions are around the world, are those places which are being newly introduced to capitalism. One of the key things I noticed on my work in Cornwall, when the very early introduction of capitalism, of capitalist organisation in Cornwall, was that the size of families grew. Because people want a roof over their heads, they want food, and they want to be loved. In a peasant society, a basically peasant society in Cornwall, you had to be 27 or 28 before you could establish an independent household. You had to accumulate little bits of wealth to pay the entry fine onto the land and establish an independent household. You had to be 27, 28. You start to get capitalist organisation in the economy down there, and within a single generation, people are getting married at 22, 23. In an age of no effective contraception, that meant there was an extra 5 years of childbearing. And what capitalism does is it offers some people that false opportunity. So, but I know, I'm sure you're more right than I'm right about the analysis of population, and that was a slight bit of what I was saying. I wasn't something I necessarily meant to get into. But that's the trouble with doing rants, you see. David, you go first and then yourself, sir.
It's another issue that can be dealt with very briefly, but I just want to very briefly make a point about your image of the analyst, that very much Brodinian picture of human development. And it seems to me that there's something very important missing from it. And in a sense, it's you that's missing from it. And people like you. That one of the things that also go through human history, right back to the very beginnings of what we know about the human beings leaving their mark on the landscape, is where's the storyteller? That these communities that you're talking about had storytellers. They had imaginations. Human beings had imaginations. The cave paintings, you go back to the cave paintings, the representations of that as long as we know about human beings, they have left the mark of their imagination. And which leads to the question, I think, about whether, in fact, we can really talk about such a thing as false consciousness. There is only consciousness, and there are consciousnesses which are false, and some consciousnesses are falser than others. But all consciousness is false in the sense that it isn't Gaia. It isn't the reality out there. Human beings are part of Gaia, but they're in it, and their perceptions of it. That's probably where I would object to the picture, the idea of separating capitalism from people, because capitalism is a product of human imagination and human labour. But it is.
It's a system within its own mind.
I know, and I think that I mean, I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying about that you don't leave the people out, whatever you do, and don't leave the children out, whatever you do. Otherwise, you know, what are we talking about? I just think that it's very, very necessary that, and if anything, a weakness of the a major weakness of the historical materialist tradition, not to have enough recognition of the importance of imagination in human life. Where there are people, there is imagination. Where there are people, there are storytellers. And what you've just done is a demonstration of that, that your story actually changes. It might be a small reverberation, but it does. You know, that and you can't exclude it. So that's why I think the what's wrong with your picture is not the picture, which is true and tragic and sad. It's the model of history, that the Brodelian, that's what's wrong with the Brodelian model of history, that it leaves the imagination out, it leaves language out, it leaves the love of art, the love of curiosities, the curiosity of human beings out, that side of it. And that has leads to debates about what consciousness is and whether it can be false, or whether it can be other than false in that sort of large.
Yeah, I was thinking directly from Gramsci's idea of false consciousness, which is, you know, you bombard the proletariat with an overwhelming flood of ideas. In order to prevent them thinking for themselves.
Yes. You give them somebody else's consciousness.
Yeah, it has an ideology and an ideological purpose, which is to prevent the class consciousness.
Yeah, I don't think
so. That's the sense in which I was using that. Well, you're going to call me a fascist.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of it with capitalism being a belief system, and a self-perpetuating belief system, as goes, you know, evolution theorists and stuff, social. But several central problems, but particularly the environment, don't seem to us. We're not looking at money. Is this move to fractional reserve banking, where you issue more money than you have in existence, means that capitalism itself cannot be zero growth. So you have to remove it, because it needs to constantly expand and ever increase growth. So it needs to encompass the world and then keep on going. It's like you said, it's like a disease. I mean, they've kept this going by credit, and that was the bit that Marx missed, is, you know, mass consumer credit, consumer demand. And that makes it even more unsustainable.
Yeah. 95% of world trade, at least up until this latest credit crunch, I haven't seen the figures. Yeah. 95% of world trade is in invisibles. So there's 5% of world trade which is actual goods and services, like goods that have been produced and made. 95% of world trade is people, capitalists, gambling on what the value. Yeah. About 5% is going to be. And that's just simply bloody nonsense. You know, and creates all sorts of problems. And it means things don't know their proper value. It means that
they've got to be constantly overvalued.
Yeah.
And the idea of weightless capitalism, where you're selling things that don't actually. Because same concepts. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, it's in the Bristol Panther a bit, but this idea of, you know, it was an assimilation of situations. You make your dreams a reality. So how they got around that was to make people's dreams extremely uninteresting. It goes almost to this Oliver James thing, where you go from survival materialism to relative materialism. And so it's a consumption that makes you feel alive, rather than for what you want, need.
Sure.
So, but it's essential. I've lost my thread a bit, but there's so many meaningless concepts, basically.
Yeah,
indeed.
Advertising.
And that's where all the waste goes. My central point is the ridiculous concept of work. This is where most of the environment damage goes. You drive to work to do pointless A, to pointless B, to do pointless D, C. It's nonsense.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Talk to me like that. I was going back to a point you made ages ago in your talk, when you said that the sustainability worked for 99% of people, but for 1% of people it didn't work. I was wondering whether you meant that the 1% of people is where the bourgeoisie and therefore capitalism developed, or whether these 1% of people are a completely different group.
No, I think I was talking about, like I said, for 99% of people through the most of human history, their daily experience and the way they lived their lives would have been about growing sustainably, living in small communities, working cooperatively, blah, 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 blah. The 1% has got all sorts of things in it. I was also saying things like the state wouldn't impinge on most people's ordinary lives. You know, the history that's written is the history of the state and the pictures and all that stuff that's very important, but how many people did it affect? And the 1% of those people may be like the kings and the barons and who lived a rarefied life and didn't ever have to grow their own food. They were particularly that bit of rent from everybody. And they're also, the 1% of people is the people who were unfortunate enough to get tangled up in a war, or to get tangled up in a rebellion, or get tangled up in some issue of high politics, which could fall at random, like the thunderbolt from the gods, and land on a community, or land on an individual. My point I was making was that for the vast majority of people would have lived their lives without a great deal of interference from the state or from politics, and would have been focused on their families and their friends and their neighbours, and growing their food. So now, 99%, it might be 95, it might be 97, but throughout human history, most people would have had that type of experience. And live a lot in their imaginations, I'm sure they did. Did you have one, sir?
Yeah.
What was it you said about capitalism started first up? What was it, like 1700s you said? You reckon that's
well, I mean, that's the testing about where capitalism first develops.
Yeah.
Maybe it starts in 1480. Maybe it starts in 1550. Maybe it starts in 1750. But wherever it starts, my argument is it's a blip in human history. It's not normal. It's not natural. It's not what we could and should expect the world to be like.
But I disagree. I reckon it's been with us since we first been on this planet. It was like the first Stone Age bloke realised he had a bigger wooden club than the bloke living opposite and started telling him what to do, else he'd hit him in the head. It started around then, you had people doing stuff for other people.
Do you know that? Do you know that the Stone Age people
had
conflict with each other? No. Well, I think I'll take one more. One of those two. Have you got to share one or
And mine's really quick.
Yeah,
a kind of right-wing argument is that, capitalism's given us all these good things, and because people, the thing they always say is, because people live a lot longer. Is that true?
It is and it isn't. It depends how you calculate life expectancy. People in medieval England will marry couples in medieval England with about 7 or 8 children, and 3 or 4 of those children would have made it past their first birthday. So there was very high infant mortality, and that's an accepted part of life. If you made it to your first birthday, you would probably pretty much likely make it to your 60th birthday, and you'd have a fair chance of making it to your 65th. The life expectancy of birth was something like 35 years. But if you get to your first birthday, you're then going to live to what we would call retirement age. If you look at the figures for life expectancy now, we're expecting women in this country to live to be 81, and we're expecting men to live to be 79. But their healthy life expectancy is about 7 years less than that. So capitalism's improved our healthy life expectancy probably by about 4 or 5 years. But it's given us 7 or 8 years on the far end of chronic illness. So people do live longer now, but the actual really worthwhile bit of that longevity isn't anything like as big as the overall increase in life expectancy.
Can I? Yeah. Okay. using history for enlighten our imagination. You said that we can see the future, we can planify the future, analyzing history. And Karl Marx said that the revolution might happen in England. It's more likely to happen in England.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen, you know, the Nazis. And nowadays, I mean, the changes is happening in countries like Venezuela or Bolivia, or the people are organizing, they're talking about democracy, real democracy, talking about trying out capitalism and so on. And how about here? How about people who know more about history, they have more access to, they have longer expectancy, life expectancy, and so the political consciousness has been rising in countries, poorest countries.
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen usually that way, isn't it? You expect that people who are better informed, have more time, better read, to rise the political consciousness.
Yeah, and are the Marxists expecting the revolution to be at the cutting edge of capitalism? And in his lifetime, the cutting edge of capitalism was in England and was in Germany. And he must have spun in his grave at the top when Russia went off, because he was never expecting it there. I think the reason that radical movements seem more dynamic and more powerful and more real in places like Venezuela and Bolivia maybe, is because they're less advanced capitalist societies, and maybe it's not so much about them. I think once they've got you educated, and I think the capitalist class have got it down to a fine art now, and they know exactly how to educate you, so you're not going to ask difficult questions. And they give you the Teletubbies, they suck you up on the Teletubbies, and they bring you on through Blue Peter and whatever else. And they've got you thinking, and they've got you just how they want you. Now, mainly in Venezuela and Bolivia, and maybe in other bits of the so-called third world, people are still thinking for themselves. People haven't been indoctrinated. The capitalist effort hasn't been. And people are protecting a way of life that exists, and protecting a way of life that their ancestors have enjoyed for generations. For us now, we're completely divorced from that. You know, I couldn't milk a cow. I couldn't grow corn. I'm completely divorced from that. Where capitalism is still emerging and still encroaching, those people have still got that way of life to cling on to. So that may be one.
Would you want to know about the other?
You were thinking about people in Mexico and Colombia who would be thinking of themselves in that capitalism is fresh and new to those countries, and that those people are selfish and thinking of themselves, when actually neoliberal capitalism is forcing those people quietly off their lands.
Yeah.
I said thinking for themselves, not of.
Are you sure thinking for themselves?
Yeah.
Not of themselves. And what's the difference?
I think what I was trying to say was that maybe the reason there's no real revolutionary dynamic in the advanced capitalist societies is because they have that hold on us now for generations and generations and generations. It's a new struggle in other parts of the world. They are clearing rainforest and trying to kick those people out. They have got a traditional lifestyle and a traditional way of life that's functional, that's worked, that they must feel they can still cling on to. We in the advanced capitalist societies have lost that. We haven't got that title of land anymore. We can't suddenly say we want the traditional lifestyle like my father had. I'd have to go back 19 generations to be pre-capitalist. It's still alive, you know, that real way of living, if I can conceptualise it, is still alive in Zapatista areas of Chiapas.
Which is kind of what Marx is on about, but is not talked about really because it didn't fit in with the 19th century view, you know, let's say the Social Democratic Parties and the progressive idea of capitalism. One of the key things is about work discipline and control of the labour, the day, or the labour hours in a day. And certainly if you go and talk to the Zapatistas, who I would call semi-proletarian, i.e. they're in this process of going from sort of farmers or landless peasants working on plantations but having a little bit of land, very much like I think the English peasantry were in that transition. What's interesting to them is they do have a concept of a discipline of labour, which I think is what a lot of the struggles in the 19th century were about. What I'm trying to say is that they a typical peasant's life. I think David's probably talked about this, I might have missed it, but typical peasant's life, you know, you've argued that they worked probably half the hours that an industrial labourer would have worked in 1830. So the transition was pretty shocking for them. You know, they had different ways of living and stuff like that. And certainly the Zapatistas are semi-proletarians. They understand that completely. I mean, they're faced with, you know, having land, which gives you a sustainability, working, you know, reasonable times, controlling their labour. I mean, E.P. Thompson's famous paper, Time, Work and Labour Discipline, talks about this. Really, really important. So they have some kind of control over their day, you know, how much they work, when they work, how they work collectively or whatever. And they recognise as semi-proletarians that they have to, because of the crisis that's gone on in the agricultural area, they have to go off and work in oil fields in Tabasco. They recognise clearly the difference between the peasant or the peasant time control that they have as a peasant with the control of wage labour. They clearly recognise those two things. And they have rejected, I mean, the Zapatistas is what I call a left turn for progressiveness. I mean, it was meant to go in this direction. They were all meant to be proletarianised, put in factories, be working in big maquiladora factories, and that kind of didn't happen with the Zapatistas. They took a left turn 20 years ago and went, no, we're actually going to go the other way. We're going to re-enclose land that's been enclosed from us. We're going to take over this land and take it out of the control of the big plantation owners and create a different society. Now, for good or bad, you know, but the problem with that is of course that it doesn't fit in with the Marxist model as such. It's like a return, it's a left turn. It's like, that's the way progress is going, we're going to go that way because actually it's better for us. You know, we've got a choice of wage labour or we've got a choice of sustainability and a collective living, and they've gone there. Right? And I think what's important is the big mystery for Marxists and the big mystery for all of that period, 200 years of that kind of labour history, is understanding work discipline, resistance to work and control over your time. And they are big issues, and they're not popular in that political period, because that was all about, no, we have to go for wage labour and then we go to socialism and then we go to communism, right? And of course they dropped all that bit of Marx and weren't interested in that, and put it underneath, washed under the carpet. And interestingly, the struggles that are going on certainly in Latin America are a lot to do with that now. And to me, it's like it's come back to on the agenda. And it's not anti-Marx, it's probably anti-Marxist, but it's certainly what Marx is talking about. He's certainly interested in that, but that's been sort of forgotten.
Thanks, Josh. Well, I'm absolutely gasping for a fight. And so I'd like to thank you for your patience and for giving me an opportunity to rant. And thank you very much.